it encourages you that like you're part of a well thought out process that's been practiced for literally centuries in a certain way that has enabled the kingdom of God to go forth.
Guess start with our intro.
Don't be fooled by the rocks that I got. Do you know that song? No. Come on. You're really that much younger than me?
Yeah, you're really millennial, Will.
Come on, you know that song. Don't be fooled by the rocks that I got. I'm still Jenny from the block. Used to have a little, now I have a lot. Don't be fooled where I came from. Don't be fooled by the rocks that I got. I'm still Jenny from the block. No. No.
Is this Eminem?
No. Jennifer Lopez. J-Lo.
Oh.
You don't
I've
know
heard
that.
Of her.
Is it really like you do not know her that well?
No.
Are you serious?
I mean, no. Like
J-Lo.
Yes.
Jennifer Lopez. What in the world?
Like, I mean, I vaguely know who she is.
No, she was married to Ben Affleck forever. Maybe they still are.
You know, we can do this in reverse, too. I can make you feel bad. Do you know who Mac DeMarco is?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Hold on. Wait, you don't know who Jennifer Lopez? Yeah, but the thing is, it's already happened before you, so you'd assume that like you have that like Rolodex of history. These are newer things that have happened, right? There's the argument. Don't be fooled.
All my stuff. We should do the intro and then we can banter more.
Okay. Well, I'm Will Schaferman.
Highly caffeinated, I'm Andrew Panic.
And this is Excessively Anglican.
A podcast for the Anglo-curious. Solid cut. Okay, nice.
Good.
That's for our theme music. We have a theme song now.
We have a theme song.
I mean, if you're listening to this, you've heard the theme song from the beginning.
Yeah, you have.
But in our timeline, which is different than yours, we just wrote it. We just finalized it like 2 weeks ago. We just put out our first episode.
Yep.
Exciting stuff.
Who wrote that theme song? It just sounds so naturally gifted in its composition.
It's actually a Grateful Dead song.
Oh, really?
No, it's not. I wrote it.
Yes, you did.
Andrew Panic, along with the
remember
a
that
lot
name,
of help from Josh Vignel, my good friend.
Thanks, Josh. Love you.
Drums by Reese Massey. Got to give everybody a fair shout
out. Credits.
It really is pretty cool. I'm sick of it already because I've listened to it about 1,000 times. But it was neat. I put down some kind of scratch stuff, and I was like, Josh, play something, and he starts playing this, and then I'm like, okay. Let's add this, like, do that again. Do that right here. Perfect. Play it. And then we just layered it on top.
It was amazing.
Modern recording stuff is cool.
I love the organ piece. I think I told you it sounds like a homey country parish, like a church in, like, Gadsden, Alabama, maybe. Oh, yeah. And yet it has that sort of indelible grace, mm-hmm. like, classic, hymny kind of composition to it. It's beautiful.
Someday, Will, we have to have an organ, a tone wheel.
That'd be great.
Hammond organ.
I love that. You play like a little bit, right?
I wouldn't claim, I'm not good enough to claim it, but yeah, I mean, I know the operation, and obviously from being able to play piano, I know how to play chords and notes and everything. So yeah. I love an organ.
So my dad, you know, I grew up in originally it was an old Episcopal church that was refreshed by its leadership and all that, but it had this beautiful organ, and my dad does play the organ. And I remember as a young kid, we would sit in the front row, he'd be playing organ, and I would just be mesmerized by his coordination. Like, how do you move hand and feet to hit different notes? You're playing piano with your toes and piano with your fingers, mm-hmm. but not just piano with your fingers, four different rows of piano with your fingers and all these knobs mm-hmm. and buttons. And he was just manhandling it, and it was amazing. And I just remember thinking, there's no way I could ever do that. And it's true, there's no way I can ever do that.
It is something to see. And it's funny because the level I'm at, I'm like, I could do that with proper training and mm-hmm. practice, mm-hmm. which, unlike you know, if you want to learn the guitar, Facebook Marketplace, $50 later, you can learn the guitar. The organ is not like that. No. You have to have somewhere where you can practice it.
That's right.
It's like the Carillion, you know, the bell tower, basically. You can get a degree in that.
Wow.
And they have silent practice bells, like in a studio, but at some point you have to go up in the tower and actually do it on the hour and play the song. It's very cool.
That's fascinating.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, Will.
Andrew.
I have questions for you.
That's a good thing.
That's what this podcast is all about.
The moment you run out of questions is the day that this podcast ends.
So true.
Somehow I don't see that ever happening. I was about
to say, fortunately, there's a lot of things to talk about.
Yeah.
And so today, we're going to talk about polity.
Hmm. Polo what?
What is polity?
What is polity?
Polity.
That you want me to answer?
That's my first question. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know what it is, but I think you'll have a better answer.
Okay. Well, so polity is a funny word, isn't it? It's like you want to hear policy in it or politics, but it's not. It doesn't give you what you want. It's polity. And so polity, besides.
Is this more J-Lo lyrics?
We should talk about J-Lo again because I'm just, I can't believe that you've like not heard of her.
I've heard of her. I don't know.
Okay. So what is polity?
Yeah. What is
polity? We are bantering a lot today. Polity is a word that people in the church use, and it can be used outside of the church, but specific for our purposes, just means how you structure the skeleton of the church, how you structure the common life of God's people. And it's as broad as a global structure and as narrow as a local church structure. And in the Anglican world, it's both. We can get into that. But polity at its highest level is just how do you put this vehicle, the concrete vehicle that is the visible thing that we call the church together.
Right. Okay. So is that just government? Because that's the term I've always used when people ask me about, when people used to ask me about the PCA, I would say, well, the primary thing that makes the Presbyterian Church, whether you're talking about PCA, USPCA, EPC, OPC, is that we have a specific form of government.
Yeah.
And is that what polity is, or is there more to it?
So there is it's in terms of its specific form of government, it's not just a local church, but beyond that. But it kind of indirectly relates to church leadership too. So how, not only is there a particular way that we structure our common life when it comes to the different aspects of a body of people, but also who leads it and why do they lead it and how do they come to leading it? So those are sort of interrelated concepts, polity and leadership, but they all form ultimately this seamless discussion around governance.
Well, cool. Then that's a question for you, is how and who leads the Anglican Church?
Yeah. There's this guy named the Pope, and he's the leader of it. No. So great question. To answer that question, I think we need to preface it with the prior, which is how is the Anglican Church structured? Because that will get into your question. When you say Anglicanism, in general, you're talking about this global historic body that, as we talked about 2 weeks ago in the History podcast, has developed over time. And there are now Anglican churches, meaning like in a certain country, there's the Anglican Church of Kenya, the Anglican Church of Rwanda, the Anglican Church of Argentina, you know, different provinces. I don't even know. There might not be one of Argentina. I think there's one, but there's definitely ones in South America. But they're just different Anglican bodies, independent but interrelated from different places around the world. And that happened in different ways. You know, you had in India, the East India Company, you had Anglican chaplains that went with those folks that started business and in some ways to colonialize India. And eventually, you have an Anglican presence, and eventually, leadership is turned over to local leaders, and that happens in Africa. Africa, it's some combination of commerce, but also missionaries that go there and start Anglican missions, and again, turned over to the local leadership.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but in modern times, the Anglican Church in North America, of which we are a part,
yes,
was more or less founded. I don't know if that's the right term. But the creation of that church was led by bishops in Africa.
Yeah, so the ACNA, the Anglican Church of North America. Yeah, so skip me ahead really quickly just to answer your question. When our newest expression of Anglicanism in America, the Anglican Church of North America, was started, it was a combination of churches that had left the Episcopal Church and some other churches that had been planted as missions from African churches. Like the church in Rwanda sent missionaries over here. A lot of them were people from America. A lot of them were white, but they were under African bishops that were sent to establish mission churches here. So they had a kind of a reverse mission thing happening.
That's cool because, yeah, when you think about missions, there's this very standard picture of white savior complex.
That's right.
White people going to Africa holding little African babies.
And, yeah. Opposite, for sure.
Yeah.
So you have this global, what they call the Anglican Communion, that begins to develop. And it is, I don't, at last count, I'm just guessing shot in the dark, they're like 40 to 50 different like provinces across the world that make up the Anglican Communion. And those provinces all have a leadership structure of their own. They have some of them have multiple archbishops depending on how big, like the church in Nigeria is so vast. I don't know like how many millions of Anglicans they have, but it's tens of millions. They have several archbishops that oversee several provinces within Nigeria, and therefore they have to have one archbishop that's singled out as like the leader of all the archbishops, and he's called the primate. And that's just a fancy Anglican word. It's literally spelled primate. So like our archbishop of the ACNA, there's only one, so he's both the archbishop and the primate. So the primary, right? That's where we get prime. The primary leader of the church.
This feels very Catholic.
Okay. Yeah.
Is he the Pope?
No, he's not the Pope.
Is he infallible?
No. He's just the chief of archbishops.
Is he better than them? Like morally?
No.
I mean, serious question.
No, it's a good question because there probably is some confusion on that point. And I'm just saying the primate is of a local province. I'm not talking about, there's not like one primate for the whole Anglican Communion.
Not the Archbishop of Canterbury? So the
Archbishop of Canterbury, he is a primate of his province because there's two archbishops in England. There's one in Canterbury and there's one in somewhere north. Where am I thinking? Oh, all the Anglicans that are really good at their Anglicanism are going to be thinking that Will is really behind.
Wow.
York. Thank you.
Okay.
So York and Canterbury, he is the primate of England. And yet he's not the Pope. There has been a historical deference shown to the Archbishop of Canterbury, naturally, right? This thing started in England. But he's never been a Pope. He's never been the sort of singular head of the Anglican Communion.
Could he make decisions for our church if he wanted to?
No.
Okay.
And there's two reasons for that. One, we'll get into later. The other one is that there just literally is no, there's nothing akin to a pope in the Anglican world. So he is not infallible. He doesn't have supreme authority to make decisions, et cetera, to issue, you know, ex cathedra declarations about some theological point of the church, yada, yada. So you have all these provinces and they all have leaders. Those archbishops are also bishops of a diocese. So we're looking at tiers here. We have the whole global structure, that's the Anglican Communion. Within that are provinces, right? Typically tied to a country. And within provinces are dioceses. That's the plural for the word diocese. Okay, this is all, if this is new to you, I'm sorry. You'll hear this several times in this podcast. We're going to make this as clear as we can, but there are just certain words you can't get around, right? So diocese is a smaller local grouping. So in America, for instance, we are in, you and I, our church, is in the Diocese of the South, which comprises basically the SEC states. So if you like your football, you're right at home at the Anglican Diocese.
Are you telling me that Texas recently came under the umbrella?
Well, actually, it's funny. They did.
Are you serious?
I'm not kidding.
They really do follow the SEC, don't they? Wow. They're
being now turned out to their own diocese, but we did take Texas in for a season.
They're getting ready to secede.
Yeah, probably. So, communion, province, diocese. Communion has a bunch of archbishops that collaborate together. Each province has its own archbishop. Each diocese has its bishop. So meaning in the Anglican Church of North America, our diocese has a bishop. His name is Foley Beach. Up until last summer, he was also the Archbishop of the Anglican Church in North America, which means that he was elected among the rest of the, I don't know, 30 to 40 odd bishops in the Anglican Church in North America to represent the whole.
And we only have one archbishop.
Yes.
So he was also the primate.
He was also the primate.
Okay.
Primate and archbishop. Yep. And we'll get into this in a second, but he also was the chief or the lead of what's called the Global Anglican Future Conference. I think we've talked about that briefly, maybe episode two toward the end, GAFCON. But that's just a GAFCON, the Anglican Comic Con.
GAFCON too.
Yeah, that's right. So let's bookmark that. Well, that's an aside. We could get distracted there. But within each diocese, of course, then are churches, right? So all of this gets down to the actual level of on the ground ministry, right? So you have in the local church, you have priests or what we would call presbyters, right? A priest is a ordained leader who is both conveying word and sacrament of the gospel, right? He is ordained to preach, to celebrate Holy Communion, so on and so forth.
So what does ordination look like in the Anglican Church?
Yep.
I feel like this is going to be an episode with a lot of asides because I've got to ask you while it's on my mind.
Yes.
Because I know, for instance, in the PCA,
yep.
Something that I always valued about that denomination is there were certain requirements. Mm-hmm. Usually, I think there are exceptions, but usually including some kind of formal education.
Yeah.
Before you could be ordained into the PCA. So yes. What does that look like in the Anglican Church?
And I should say this too. There's both ordination of priests and of deacons, and we can talk about both of those. Does the PCA, do they ordain deacons? Is it literally the same? Maybe it's called ordaining them, but it's not the same process, I imagine, than ordaining a presbyter.
My understanding, mind you, I've been out of it for like a year now, but I believe that deacons were not ordained, more recently they are, and I believe that elders are ordained, but it's not in the same way.
Yeah. It's like, I remember Tim Keller talking about, like, they had ordained deacons at Redeemer. They also had commissioned deaconesses, and he drew a distinction between those two. But anyway, the point is, we ordain both priests and deacons. The process of becoming a priest is lengthy. I mean, there is a theological component. You have to go through a training program of theological study. Usually that means getting your MDiv, your Master's of Divinity, at an approved seminary or some other similar course of study that's tracked. And usually there's an examination you take. But it's well beyond that. There's a deep process of discernment that happens. And ideally, in the perfect case scenario, you don't go to seminary until that all has happened. So, like, let's do a quick case study. You know, said person comes to the head pastor of the local church, and that person's like, hey, I feel called to ordained ministry in the church. And the rector or the head pastor is like, okay, well, let's discern that together. They spend some time getting to know each other, or maybe the rector himself reaches out to this person and is like, hey, I think you're called to this. They begin this discussion. They set up a local church discernment committee, which is a requirement of ordination. So the local church goes through usually about a 3 to 6 month sort of investigation of asking all sorts of questions. There's a template for that that the diocese puts together, so on and so forth. They get through that, and if there's a common consensus that, yes, this person is supposed to take the next step, they get kicked to the church's vestry, which is basically a governing body within the local church, and that vestry approves or disapproves of that recommendation from the church discernment committee. We're getting lost in the weeds, but the point is there's a thick process, and then once they get approved by the vestry, they get kicked to the diocese, and then they go through their own process of working toward the goal of, as the Lord leads, ordination. Usually it's about a multi-year process. If that person then goes off to seminary, or if they've done seminary, maybe it's a little quicker, but within a year or two. there's usually, you're always ordained as a deacon before you're ordained as a priest. That may be a difference within the Anglican world than the Presbyterian world. So historically, back in the day, as the early church was getting more developed with its structure, there was a testing ground. Like, you wouldn't be ordained as a priest until you'd been ordained as a deacon and proved your leadership as a deacon first. So we continue in that model, and everyone's first ordained as a deacon, and you're never unordained as a deacon, meaning like anyone who's a priest is also first and foremost a deacon.
Interesting.
They're always, so you're a deacon. Sir, I'm a deacon, but I'm also a priest, right?
Like, when were you?
Like, you don't lose your diaconal call. The heart of a priest is also a heart of a deacon. Like, at the heart of our call is to serve, to give of ourselves, to support the ministry of God's church. I was ordained as a deacon in 2017 and a priest in 2018.
Okay.
So I was working up at a church in DC during that time.
So let's also,
yeah,
before we so that, go,
that's a rabbit trail.
Yeah, right? It is. We've gone down a rabbit trail, and I will reorient us real quick, yeah, and say that we came down from the multiple levels and we started talking about local church, yes, governance.
Yeah.
But my other question is, you've used two terms. You've used, mm-hmm, priest.
Yep.
Which is scary and Catholic.
Yep.
And you've used the term rector.
Yes.
Which is Ben Rector, our favorite artist.
Yeah. That's all it is. It's his last name.
Anglicans just really like him.
Yes.
But no, seriously, what is a rector? Yeah. How is it different than a priest? Why do we say priest? Yeah. I've never heard you call yourself a priest. I've heard you say pastor and rector.
Yep. It depends on the context, but most of the time I'm going to say pastor, especially here in the South. And it's, yeah, a bunch of Baptists that
I like,
get scared by.
It makes, don't say Baptist. It makes me feel better too.
Yeah.
I like the term pastor. I usually call you my pastor.
Yeah.
Or my boss.
So
occasionally friend.
We talked about primate. You're also my friend too. Primate and archbishop. So that's a similar analogy to priest and rector. So
okay,
you could have multiple priests on staff of a church, but there's only one head priest, and that head priest is called the rector. There's only one priest at our church because we're brand new, but I am, like, fully was the primate and the archbishop. I am the rector and a priest.
Oh, so you just didn't have any competition.
No competition, baby.
Nice.
There's only one fish in this pond. Yeah. But hopefully in time, as we grow, we'll have the capacity to bring on another priest.
Unscripted question.
Yes.
Which not all our questions are scripted, but if we brought on, say there were four of you, could you stop being the rector for a season and still be a priest on staff? Or is that sort of...
technically, yes, but it would... Usually the reason you do that is probably not for, like... There's probably something that's happened that would, like...
Not a good thing.
Not usually a good thing. That would happen in only specific situations. So, for instance, I have a church planting coach who is now a bishop of the Diocese of Christ Our Hope. It's an East Coast diocese of the Anglican Church in North America. His name is Alan Hawkins, and he started a church in Greensboro, North Carolina, Church of the Redeemer. And he was the rector for 15 years, however long it was planted, until he was elected as bishop. Now, my understanding, and Alan, if you're out there listening to this somewhere, which you're probably not because you have a lot of more important things to do, but if he is, I may get this not exactly right, but I think the gist of it is that he actually, even before he took over full-time as the bishop of that diocese, he had another rector under him. He basically put somebody in the slot of rector while he oversaw the overarching vision for the church, because they were a church like ours that not only has a parish, which is like Anglican speak for the actual church itself, but they had a farm. They had what they called an abbey, where they did different sort of business entrepreneurial stuff, and they had a park. And they bought like 10 to 15 acres of
land.
This
is sounding familiar.
Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
This is what Will really wants to do. And also what I really want to do.
I think you should phrase it, this is what we will do.
This is what we are working on.
That's right. By God's grace. So Alan wasn't the rector. He put somebody there, and I don't know what he called himself. But then he became bishop. And in some cases, that bishop, wherever they were as the church, that church becomes what's called the cathedral. Meaning it's the principal church of that diocese.
Okay.
And so you are the bishop that is located in that cathedral, but you have a dean who is like the rector, but because it's a cathedral, it has to have a different name, right? So he's the dean.
Keep it nice and simple.
Yeah, nice and simple. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that's like one good, yeah, that's a time that.
Yeah, but like if, the like, they're probably a bad situation if, like, I'm rector and then all of a sudden I'm like, I don't really want to do this anymore. I put a rector in my place and I kind of demote myself.
Yeah.
That would cause a lot of awkward, like, leadership stuff.
Okay. Speaking of leadership stuff.
Yes.
Back to the overarching, is it overarching or yes. overarching?
Arching. Think archbishop.
The overarching.
Yes.
Church structure. We'd gotten down to the local level.
Yeah.
A rector is the head pastor.
Yes.
You can have other pastors or priests. Mm-hmm. And then
deacons. Then you have deacons.
What exactly does a deacon do?
Yes.
How are they different than a priest or a pastor or a rector?
So the best way to describe this is go straight back to Acts. So the 12 apostles are commissioned, ordained, if you will, by Jesus to be the initial leadership structure of the new church that he's established on earth. And those apostles are practicing the ministry of the word, right? They're to preach and ultimately to be sacramental, to celebrate the sacraments, all that. The issue that happens early on in Acts is that they're having to do all this admin work, right? There's like the sort of overseeing of the distribution of support for the widows of the Jerusalem church, and they're having to do that while also trying to preach, and they just don't have enough time for it all. They're burning out, basically. And so it's the first example of like the church saying, let's try to avoid burnout and in fact put somebody like a deacon in place who can oversee more of the practical side of the church's ministry, administration, care. You know, what a deacon does is pretty broad. I liked how Tim Keller once talked about this in terms of a spectrum. You have everything from like on the one side is like mercy ministry, justice ministry, all the way to like church administration. And it's a scope, but that's a deacon can kind of flexibly do a lot of different things. But basically their role is to support the priest or the priests if there are multiple of them. So that's a role of a deacon, but they're also ordained. So they're not just like a practical help. They're not like an executive assistant. They also share in the same apostolic authority that the priest has. So the apostles, when they set apart the class of deacons, those seven deacons in Acts 6, with Stephen being one of them, Philip, those deacons are literally ordained. The apostles lay their hands upon them, conveying the authority that Jesus gave them. And so they're all part of this, what they call the seamless robe of church governance, which is the apostles who ultimately become the bishops. We may get into that later. And those bishops can ordain priests who also, and can also ordain deacons. And it's all part of the same sort of like leadership structure. And when you, and there's the last sort of thing I should say is when you think about a bishop, we may have talked about this previously, but it's like a Russian doll where you have a deacon who is inside of a priest who is inside of a bishop. So a bishop is all of those. Even as a bishop, you never lose your diaconal calling. And a deacon may become a priest may become a bishop.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Doesn't?
Yes. No, okay. It does. It does. I'm with
lots
you.
Of language all at once. Yeah. And I suppose we should say it's a technical heavy podcast episode.
I guess it has to be.
Yeah.
So, and maybe we can get in, you know, maybe have another episode about like more of the why, but we have to understand the what and how first.
Sure.
I have to understand that to ask.
And also, good questions. I guess one question that some people, and I don't know if you wrote this down, I can't remember, like, we talked about why are there, you know, priests and deacons, but like the big question I think a lot of people have is like, why do you have bishops?
That's right? Literally.
Did you? Okay.
That's literally the next one. Okay. So go ahead.
Look at you. Me.
Because that feels particularly Catholic and on a practical side. So I showed the first episode to a friend and his sort of follow up. The one like major question he had about anything we talked about is he was like, why do y'all have bishops? He's like, mm-hmm. I don't know how I feel about that. And it wasn't even just like a sort of philosophical question. He was like, practically, you know, his perspective, and honestly mine too, his perspective at least was like, you just have this person at the top that can just hand down decisions. And if you somehow got a, you know, unfavorable person up there, they could make unfavorable changes. And is that really how it works? I guess is part of the question too.
Good question. Yeah. So starting with the scriptural basis and then moving to more of the practical, in the New Testament, just kind of like informally talked about this, but the apostles become the model for bishop. You have Paul, for instance, as an apostle. And, you know, obviously by the fact that Paul is named an apostle means that there are multiple apostles that go beyond those initial 12. But those apostles, very quickly, we see Paul functioning in a bishop-like capacity, right? So he's planting churches in these different places, but then he's placing local elders, local priests, if you use that language, or presbyters.
Presbyters.
He's putting those in place at a local level. Think of Timothy, Titus. These are guys that he is overseeing, sending letters to, communicating with, encouraging, and in some cases exhorting. He's doing the work of a bishop as a sort of geographically focused person. Like he's saying, like, all right, there's this area, Asia Minor, we need people there, and I'm going to oversee that. We already get the model for a bishop there. And right out of the gates of the canon, right after the Bible is written, the New Testament part, you get bishops. Like the early church goes straight into that. And so they saw it as being the most natural progression from the start of the church into its full-formed expression. And so that's the first piece, like why? Well, scripturally, it's supportable there. And if you go back, we talked about this briefly at some point, I think. No, we didn't. The Old Testament, the model for bishop, priest, and deacon, and even deaconesses, is inherent in the temple structure. So you had the chief priest, he would be like the archbishop. You had the priests, which would have been the priests or the presbyters. You had the Levites who supported the priests, who were like the deacons. And then you had what were called simply the ministering women who were at the doors of the temple or the tabernacle. And they were like the deaconesses. And that whole structure, it's amazing when you look back at it, the paradigm that the early church right out of the gates of the canon adopts to a T. Like you have bishops, priests, deacons, deaconesses. And so a lot of times we like to separate the discussion of church leadership from the priestly tabernacle and temple model, but the early church didn't seem to think that it should be separated. Actually, they saw it as one continuum. It was like a reincarnation, if you will, with a new covenant perspective. Obviously, you're not slaying animals. That's right. The sacrifice has already been made through Jesus, but the structure of leadership is there. It's inherent. Did I just blow your mind?
A little bit.
I got blown when I read, do you know Peter Lightheart?
No.
Do you know that name? He's a Presbyterian. You should.
Oh. It's true. I do know every Presbyterian.
You do. Very well connected. Peter Lightheart, he's actually in Birmingham, and he planted a church actually in Homewood, but he was for a long time at a church called Trinity Presbyterian. It's a CREC
church. I really should know this person. I might know this person. Trinity in Montgomery?
No, in Birmingham. It's not a PCA, it's a CREC PCH, or Presbyterian Church. I don't even know what the acronym stands for,
okay,
but that's what it is. And he did a lot of work on typology and still has. He started this thing called the Theopolis Institute, which was like thinking through how the imagery of the Old Testament conveyed itself onto the New, and how we like think in terms of like imagery and typology. Anyway, he does this whole study, and him and I think it's Rich Lusk, who's his partner in crime, they did this whole write-up on this prefiguring of church leadership in the Old Testament, and it blew my mind.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the first part of your question, like why bishops?
Right. And then the second question was
practically.
Practically, you know, does that not create issues? Whereas in the PCA, we have something akin to that, because we have people that oversee a presbytery or a, you know, same thing as a diocese. But they decisions are pretty much always made by a group and a vote, even at multiple levels.
Yeah. So this is so the way that decision making happens in Anglican churches is it's kind of a blend of what you just discussed. So when it comes to like the bishop's role, his one of his chief roles, he's the pastor to the pastors, but he's also the guardian of its theology. So he is to be one of the sobering calls of a bishop is to uphold the historic doctrine of the church. Now, there are examples where that has not happened. There are examples all throughout history, not just in the Anglican church, where that's happened. There's also examples where a board of elders does the same thing.
Sure.
And I think the argument of like, well, one guy in control doing that, it happens in both arenas. And unfortunately, a college of elders it can be privy to the same or can be prone to the same mistake as a singular bishop. So it goes both ways. But what I would say is, you know, in an Anglican structure, you have the local church making decisions for its own local missional context. In particularly in the Anglican Church of North America, the bishop is there to guard theology. He's there to oversee the pastoral health and wellness of his diocese. He is putting together initiatives like church planting and overseeing the flourishing of God's mission through this particular geographical space. But in the ACNA, when they started this new denomination, and this isn't totally unique to the rest of the Anglican world, but it's they made a point to express this, and it's called subsidiarity. So it's the principle of subsidiarity, which means that to the degree that a decision can be made at the most local or smallest level, it should be. So decisions of mission and modes of ministry, even down to the style of worship and down to how you put together the service, like there's certain constraints, like we work within what we have in terms of our liturgies. But there's a wide variety of Anglican churches in the ACNA, and part of the reason for that is the principle of subsidiarity. Those local churches have a lot of autonomy, and those local churches, we haven't gotten to this yet, have both a rector, who's the singular leader, but he's also supported by an elected body from the church of lay leaders called the vestry. It's another fancy term. It just means it's similar to a what you would have is the session of a PCA church or a group of elders. The difference is they're not elected and they're not elders. They're lay leaders, men and women, who are elected literally through a process of voting by the local body to say, we want you to be our sort of voice and representation for church decision making. And they the vestry works with the rector. So there is collegiality at the local level, but then it works its way up. The bishop is not just a singular bishop by himself. He's in a college of bishops. And when decisions are made for the theology of the Anglican Church of North America, it's not made by a singular bishop. It's made by a college of bishops. And there's an archbishop who helps to facilitate that conversation and to help bring them to discussion and bring them into a conclusion.
But can he...
He doesn't make decisions by himself.
Okay.
So he's part of that college of bishops.
He doesn't have some kind of trump card.
Right. It has to be, different things have to be voted on in different ways. And I don't know all of the like minutia of like the constitution of the ACNA and how, you know, we definitely don't need to do that. But the point is it must be done collegially, even though for a particular, like, so Archbishop Foley, let me give you a prime example of how he has decision-making power on his own. When we were wanting to plant a church, the ACNA, because it's so new, sometimes church plants happen through geographical dioceses, like a plate, like the Diocese of the South. There are other dioceses that were started that were non-geographical, like churches for the sake of others, what they call C4SO, or even the Diocese of Christ Our Hope, which we talked about earlier. They have a broad swath of places that they plant churches in. And so I was exploring where to plant this church, like which diocese to plant it out of, and Foley, being the bishop of the area, the geographical area that we live in was able to say, if you're going to plant, you need to plant with us. So that was an example of a decision that he could make on his own to say, this is going to be how it is, which makes sense.
So I think I know the answer to this, but this podcast is for the Anglo curious. And right. So, you know, maybe this is a question that could come up. Could the bishop of a diocese tomorrow wake up and say, in our diocese, we now believe that the disciples sold candy bars door to door and y'all all have to follow
that? They didn't?
No, Will. There were no candy bars back then.
Why did you do this to me?
You know,
yeah.
You understand my point?
Correct. That's right. No, that's not in the purview of a bishop's authority. Correct. Like to just like ex cathedra decide, meaning like from the seat of the bishop, decide on like some like theological point. That's just, yeah, no.
Could they say tomorrow, this church is now closed?
No, I mean, you would have to have warrant and reason for something to shut down. Like the bishop could, there's a whole process of things. Like if a priest, for instance, is acting out of line, there's a series of steps that's modeled after Jesus's plan of like—
Matthew 18.
Correct. How you go to someone. So there's like something called like a godly admonition, which is like a very, it's like a slap on the wrist of like, you shouldn't like stop doing this. And if the priest persists, then there's another layer, and then there's another layer beyond that. So there's a process built on the Matthew 18 principle that's part of our constitution of how the bishop handles priests that are either theologically out of the line or behaviorally out of the line, so on and so forth. And that's, for me, there's a great comfort in knowing that there is somebody who is making those calls, making those decisions. Like their example, for instance, there was a church in Nashville. I'm not going to sort of go into details, but there's a church in Nashville that had started to get theologically way off the rails. And the bishop of that diocese, it was a part of a non-geographical diocese, the bishop of the diocese sat down with the rector and said, hey, your theology is beginning to be out of alignment with our denomination and our diocese. We need to figure this out. And ultimately that church, I don't know if they decided to leave or the bishop said, it's like, you can't continue to be part of this diocese if you're going to express that theology here. And so they left. They're now part of the Episcopal Church. Hmm. And so there are examples of that where like, that is the bishop's role to guard the theology of the church. And when it's not being practiced, to actually bring about discipline. And that's not a fun thing. That's not an easy thing, but that's part of the role and calling, the burden on a bishop.
So going back to one other thing that you mentioned, you talked briefly about the vestry.
Yeah.
So I might do more practical examples here because this is very helpful for me.
Yeah.
To say like, what can a bishop do? What can a bishop not do?
Yeah.
What authority, I guess, does a vestry have? How are they chosen?
Yep.
All those good things. Tell me about vestries.
Right. Well, it's a great question because
I'm going to start my investigation.
Oh, look at you. Only a 4 on the Enneagram would say something such. Well, our church is working through a book, not the whole church, but we don't have a vestry yet because we are not, in the eyes of our diocese, we're not a fully self-sustaining congregation.
We've not been particularized to give you a Presbyterian word.
So we're not self-sustaining financially yet. We have a little bit to go until then. And so we're called a mission. So before you become a vestry, it's a mission council, which is not a voting body. The main difference is a mission council is purely an advisory council. A vestry actually votes on things. The vestry, this is really important. The book we're going through is written by the guy who was the rector at probably, I think, the largest Anglican church in North America, at least for a time, Christ Church Plano. His name's David Roseberry. And he wrote a book called The Bishop, the Rector, and the Vestry. So if there's one book to read, if you're like a church like governance nerd, and you want to go deep into this stuff, that's the book to get. And that tells you the relationship specifically between the rector and the vestry. So to just be like plain speaking about this, the rector has the authority of the church, right? Like the vestry and the rector are not competing authorities. They're not equal authorities. The rector has the authority. The vestry does vote on things, but it's usually things that are supporting the vision of the church and of the rector. So like when, let's say like one day we as a church are building a building, or we're trying to acquire a property, the vestry is going to vote on different properties. They're going to vote on how we structure financing, that kind of stuff. But they're not voting on like, hey, what's the next sermon series? Or what is the next outreach opportunity for our church? Like the vestry may well consult the vestry on those things, but those are the things—
The rector. Yeah, so you're saying the rector—
can consult the vestry and say, hey guys, I'm thinking about this ministry. We have an outreach coordinator here on staff. They're working, like, we kind of want to keep you in the loop on things, but get your insights too, which is what I do all the time now with our mission council. I use them. They function like a vestry. They don't vote on things, but I highly value
their perspective. I've heard you talk to them, and they crushed our dreams about having Sandra McCracken.
They did, yeah. We wanted to host Sandra McCracken for a Christmas concert last year.
Which, in hindsight—
was definitely the right decision, because we were way too early in our development as a church.
Yeah.
But it would have also been amazing. One day, Sandra, if you're out there listening, yes, bookmark us for another year.
Also, Sandra, if you're listening— do you not have something better to do?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Yes. If you are actually listening to this podcast, gosh, I would be very honored.
Yeah. Let us know.
Anywho, where were we?
Before Sandra. We started nerding out about Sandra McCracken is actually our favorite artist between us.
Saint Sandra McCracken. Yeah.
Yeah.
We love Sandra. We sing her a lot.
We do. Usually once a Sunday, actually.
It might sometimes be excessive, twice.
But
yeah.
We like Sandra.
Usually if it's like we're like, can't do two Sandras. So we'll do like a Sandra McCracken independent song. And then we'll like use one of the ones that she sang for Indelible Grace.
Right.
It's labeled Indelible Grace, but it's really Sandra McCracken.
Or the City of Light song that she sang with them.
That's right.
Or the one, yeah.
So we were talking about vestries. We're talking about rectors. I guess, what are the other questions that you have on your mind with regard to how the Anglican Church functions, just structurally? We talked about bishops. Anything else that you need to know?
I feel like in a very technical sense, we covered the structure.
Yep.
We sort of understand how... we haven't actually really talked about... So you mentioned the process of how a priest becomes a priest.
Yep.
So you mentioned that part of the process of becoming a priest is to first become a deacon.
Mm-hmm.
Are there people that are uniquely called to only become a deacon? And does that process look different? Do they usually go to school?
Yeah.
How are they selected? And is it always like, you know, an inward calling, or is it more often maybe the rector looks at them and says, you should start down this path?
Yeah. Well, starting from the end of your question, it can be either way. There can be some sense within the person, and ideally it's both, or it's the rector saying, hey, I think you should think about this. But at some point there needs to be a sense of call. Like, it can't just be like, I was told to do this, so I'm doing it. So a deacon does have some level of theological education. It's not to the same level that's required for a priest, naturally, just in terms of their scope of ministry. The deacon goes through a discernment committee, goes through a discernment process, similar to the priestly process. They're ordained in the same kind of way. You know, the bishop comes to town, they have a special service of ordination. Oftentimes it's grouped with others that are being ordained. In our case, often it happens during our annual synod. But the deacon, when they're ordained, they're already in the mindset of whether they're going to be what they call a transitional deacon, meaning that it's the stepping stone toward becoming a priest. It's a sort of probationary period and proving your leadership and being tested in that. Or they're seeking ordination solely to be what they would call either vocational or a permanent deacon, which is because they're for so long in church history, the transitional diaconate, to use a fancy term, the traditional deacon was so normal and common, we actually sort of started to lose our theology for a permanent deacon. We started to lose, really, why do we have deacons in the first place? Only recently, I would say the last 25 years, really, have we really began to bring back the deacon and bring back the purpose for the deacon. And really, at the heart of the call of the deacon, and you can look this up in the Book of Common Prayer under the ordination service for the deacon, they are to represent the needs of the world to the church and represent the church to the world. So they have this dual function. And it's kind of priestly at its heart in the sense that they're saying to the church, here's what the world looks like and what its needs are out here and how you can be involved in that. And then they're turning around to the world and saying, here's what the church is all about. Let me help you see how we want to be the hands and feet of Christ for your brokenness and where the needs of the world exist.
So are deacons on staff?
So, yes and no. I mean, they might be in a paid staff capacity. There are deacons that work on paid staff roles for churches. There are also deacons that are ordained and they are located within a church, but they're not a paid staff member, but they're still doing diaconal work on behalf of the church.
Sure.
And I would say it's probably a mix, maybe 50-50 across the board of whether they're like a paid staff member or they just are ordained. And you can even have technically priests that are not staff priests that are ordained, but they like help out and every now and then they celebrate communion. They preach every now and then, sort of like what William Bondurant, you guys don't know who this is, but we have a guy who has helped preach. He used to be an ordained elder in the PCA, and he's helped me elder. Out, teaching elder, there you go. So he was ordained. He's not ordained as a priest, although that may happen at some point, but he is functioning as a sort of support to me. And if, for instance, if he were to be ordained one day as a priest, that would mean that we have a commissioned, ordained person to be able to preach and to be able to celebrate communion. Like if I'm gone on a Sunday, we could have somebody to step in to help do that.
So is he currently a lay preacher?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that leads me to one other question that's a bit in the weeds, a bit specific. But when I joined the church, mm-hmm. I was not... What's the word? I was received.
That's right.
And Foley basically...
During our service of confirmation.
Yes. He basically said, you know, we acknowledge that you are a baptized believer. Mm-hmm. You've professed your faith publicly before.
Yeah.
You were just being received into this church. What does that look like for someone who's been ordained as a pastor or a priest in a different denomination?
Yeah. So you mean if to bring them in as an ordained person that was ordained somewhere else? Yeah. It's different. It's a case by case thing.
Okay.
But in many cases, if somebody was ordained in a denomination that the Anglican Church would easily recognize, usually the process of being ordained, it's a more abridged process than it would be for somebody that's like about to go to seminary or just got out of seminary, somebody that's already been vetted through like a PCA setting. Especially there's a lot that we PCA, have in common. We're very close cousins, sure. In terms of denominations. So yeah, there's usually tends to be a less lengthy process. It's not like it happens overnight. You still go through the typical steps, but maybe there are certain things that can be more shortened in terms of time. Yeah.
And if you are a PCA pastor, 999 times out of 1,000, you already have your MDiv, which is one of the longest parts.
That's right.
So you've got you would become a deacon first, though, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You would still become a deacon first.
That's right.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, to summarize, to close, to wrap things up nicely, how would you specifically, this is finally a less technical question to end on a lighter note. In your opinion, how does the Anglican way of doing government, the Anglican polity, how does it reflect the mission of Jesus, the mission that he gave to his disciples? Mm-hmm. How does it help us as a whole, help me as a lay person to do that mission?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is it's encouraging to know that as an Anglican, you are part of a visible global body. So what's happening here is not disconnected from what's happening in an Anglican church in Nairobi. Like, you are connected. In fact, we didn't talk about this, but more than half of the global Anglicans worldwide are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
So we are actually in the minority
yeah.
of Anglicans as white North Americans. Majority of them are Black Africans. You have brothers and sisters from every tribe and tongue across the world that are part of the same visible expression of God's church on earth. And that's a really cool thing to just think about, the interconnectedness. And, you know, of course, that's true of the Orthodox, a lot of the Orthodox churches, is true of the Catholic Church. But to be part of a truly Catholic order, Catholic body of believers that has, the word Catholic just means of the whole. So, right? So it's of the whole church. It's an expression of the whole, of interconnectedness. And how does that encourage you? It encourages you by remembering that, like, the church isn't just, you know, a group of Southerners in Birmingham that are worshiping together. It's actually this body of people from all across the world, from different cultures, different backgrounds, that all come together under the same name of Jesus. So that's pretty cool. So that's number one. Number two, the structure is in place as a way to continue the mission of God, that we have bishops, we have dioceses, and they're thoughtfully implemented in order to encourage mission. So our diocese, and you could say this of networks of churches and other denominations, but our diocese has a very large fund that they dedicate every year to church planting. We are the recipient of that. We have a grant that we get every year. It's not a ton of money. It's not like it funds the whole church, but it's a significant value that enables us to continue to extend the kingdom of God in this place. And so how does that encourage you? It encourages you that, like, you're part of a well thought out process that's been practiced for literally centuries in a certain way that has enabled the kingdom of God to go forth. And the last thing I would simply say is, we talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago, but the actual bishop role, to be part of a denomination that has bishops, is to locate yourself in the historic extension of the church from the apostles forward. There's something beautiful about seeing an emblem or an icon, if you will, in the bishop of the apostolic order by which we have received our faith. If that's too high thinking for you, grab me another time or DM us through YouTube or put a comment on there, but we would love to talk to you more about it. There's something about this structure that is meant to remind us that we are part of something that's global, part of something that's historic, and yet with all of that, highly missional in a particular place and context like our own.
Very cool. Well, that's it. We know all about polity now.
Look at you. If you've listened to this entire episode, well done.
Yeah, seriously.
We had a lot of technicalities in this
one. Kudos. We're going to have to put up a diagram or something.
Seriously.
That's not a bad idea, actually. We should host.
Could be helpful.
Maybe by the time you're listening to this, we'll have a link for you.
And maybe by the time you listen to this, you're actually about to attend our annual conference that we'll host, the Accessibly Anglican Conference here in Birmingham.
Right. That's right, yeah. But if this is your first time listening, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
We're having a great time. I don't think we're ever going to run out of things to talk about.
Quite true.
If this is your first one, go back and listen to some of the other ones.
Yeah.
Because this is probably a confusing place to start. But if somehow this pulled you in, like, we got great stuff.
Yeah.
And we're going to have some great stuff ahead. So look out every Sunday night at some undisclosed time. We'll be dropping a new episode so you can listen to it Monday morning on your commute.
Signing out. Peace.
Peace.